From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A federal judge in Detroit clears up the confusion about green card holders and travel to seven mostly Muslim countries.
We're telling people to take this order with you, put it in your pocket while you're traveling or on your cell phone, so in case the customs will not allow you entry.
The state of Michigan Unemployment Insurance Agency falsely accusing tens of thousands of fraud. A class action lawsuit is pending.
This is a mess, and it is unconscionable for the state to continue to fight paying these people back.
In Detroit, not a lot of jobs, not a lot of money. That's led to a sharing, giving underground economy.
If someone in your neighborhood needs something, you can give it to them because at some point in the future, they might have something that you need and you know that they'll still be there.
Plus, we'll talk with a Republican legislator who's behind the effort to expand the Freedom of Information Act to the Michigan legislature. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up, a federal judge in Detroit has made a ruling regarding the White House's recent executive order on immigrants and refugees. And then later in the show, just how much wisdom can you gain by listening to children?
My mouth was constantly involuntarily dropping open with their insights. And I realized I wasn't teaching them anything. They were teaching me. Or at the very least, that we were really engaging just as fellow perplexed human beings, one of whom happened to be a lot older than them.
But first, let's take a look at a couple of news items from this week with Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Kim Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. This week, Republicans and Democrats in Lansing seem to agree it's time to expand the state's open record laws to cover the governor and the legislature. Michigan's only one of a couple of states that don't already require that. Vicki, this has been proposed before, even passed by the House, but the Senate killed it. What are the prospects this time?
I think the prospects are very good. There's multiple bills for one package. It seems to be a very strong bipartisan effort. They've worked very hard to craft some carve-outs for communications directly to constituents to solve some of the privacy issues that we have as legislators dealing with constituent issues. So I think there's a very good chance that this package will pass.
Ken, this seems to leave a sizable exemption. I would call it a loophole for correspondence between legislators and their constituents. I mean, who is a constituent? Could it be your voter in your district, or could it be some corporation who wants to talk about to lobby for some deal? What do you think about that?
Well, from my point of view, this exemption for constituent communication is, frankly, essential. From a legislator's standpoint, if a constituent writes you a letter or sends you an email about a problem, I don't think it's fair to have that, you know, subject to FOIA. That constituent, by name, has a certain kind of problem or issue that needs to be solved. And frankly, I think it's a good exemption, and I don't think it's going to pass a legislature without that kind of exemption in it.
Well, let me give you an example. Let's say that you know that John Smith gave Ken Sikkema a bunch of money in the last election, and you want to see what kind of correspondence is going on between those two. You'd be prohibited from doing that.
Well, it's not going to be perfect from a reporter or media standpoint who would want everything disclosed and subject to FOIA. But I will just reiterate my point. When I was in the legislature and this issue came up, I took the same position that the current majority leader, Arlen Meekhoff, has taken about sort of constituent communication, that without that kind of exemption in there, and for that reason, that it's not fair to a constituent to have their name and issue and problem potentially disclosed. And for that reason, I just don't think it's going to pass without that kind of exemption in it. Now, is it perfect? No, it's not going to be perfect, but I think that exemption is essential.
Yeah, Lester, I called some of the bill sponsors and talked to them about the FOIA and the exemption. And the loophole that you're talking about could possibly be there, but the fact is, if you are a business calling a legislator and you are not a constituent, and it's not a constituent problem that you're trying to resolve, And sometimes we do have businesses with constituent problems related to tax refunds and tax questions. Then you are subject to the FOIA and the communications. So, for example, there was a story a few years ago about Brooks Patterson reaching out to several legislators to talk about redistricting in Oakland County for the county commission. And none of that was subject to FOIA because we didn't have an Open Records Act. But if Mr. Patterson had contacted anybody other than his particular state representative, and that state representative then contacted other state representatives regarding that issue, those communications would be all FOIA-able. In addition, lobbyists are not considered constituents under these bills, and any communication between a lobbying organization is therefore subject to FOIA. As Ken said, it's not going to be perfect, but it is a move, a strong move in the right direction.
Let's look at another story this week. Michigan Democrats say the state's congressional and legislative districts are gerrymandered to give Republicans an unfair advantage. Attorney Mark Brewer, the former state chair of the Democratic Party, is handling that lawsuit. Vicki, what evidence will Brewer and the Democrats use to convince the courts that it's unfairly gerrymandered?
I think there's several bits of information that they're going to use, some quite compelling. And that is the idea that Democrats are packed into very concentrated districts under the current redistricting scheme, which means that the number of Democratic votes in the state for state representative. Let me go back for a second and give you a real example of Oakland County in this last election. There were more Democratic votes for state representatives, regardless of district, in Oakland County. And yet the lion's share of state representatives are Republican. And that's because the districts are packed in the Democratic areas with Democrats. So you could have very uncompetitive districts. And then the Republican districts are spread over a larger area for more representation. And you can see it clearly. The other argument that they will probably use is the argument on gerrymandering and the way that the districts were cut. And if you see some of the congressional districts, I'm telling you, the one I'm in, the 14th, is just a nightmare of gerrymandering and salamander shapes. It's really kind of ridiculous.
Ken, Democrats in Wisconsin had some success in federal court with a similar suit. What kind of defense might Republicans offer?
Well, this Wisconsin decision by the federal district court is potentially changes the game here. Now, I say potentially because ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court is going to have to make a decision. And, you know, until that happens, we just simply don't know. The lawsuit you're referring to in Michigan, or the potential lawsuit that Mark Brewer wants to file, is going to be depend any of a success or failure is going to be a function of how the Supreme Court rules on this Wisconsin decision. So I don't think anybody's in a position to know yet whether this lawsuit is going to, you know, have any real impact or not. It could, but it depends on the U.S. Supreme Court.
The Michigan Unemployment Insurance Agency reached an agreement with plaintiffs in a federal lawsuit this week. The state agency wrongly accused tens of thousands of people of cheating on unemployment claims. There's still, though, a separate class action suit before the Michigan Court of Claims. Attorney General Bill Schuette is fighting that class action suit. If the state was wrong, which led to a lot of grief for a lot of people, including garnished wages and so forth, Vicki, why is Schuette fighting against them?
I don't know. I think part of his job is to protect the interests of the state, and there's potentially millions of dollars at stake. Let's not forget that the MIDAS system, the electronic system used, falsely accused claimants of fraud without giving them due process. And then the state went after these folks and started to garnish their wages, take their federal income tax refunds and their state income tax refunds, and then slap them with up to a 400% penalty. So if you were accused of fraud over $1,000, you suddenly had $4,000 to pay back in addition to the $1,000 plus penalties and interest. It was outrageous. It caused tremendous stress. And then there's concerns about the statute of limitations, and these people were not informed of these actions and that they were accused of fraud until their appeals period had already lapsed. This is a mess, and it is unconscionable for the state to continue to fight paying these people back.
Ken, one of the things that struck me was that the agency actually was in denial for a long time, and I kept thinking, man, this is like Flint all over again. What did you make of that? Did the Snyder administration not learn a lesson?
Well, I had the same reaction, Lester, that, you know, when the state sort of for 2 years kind of refused to fess up to this problem, you know, it does sort of feel like Flint, but it's not a matter of did they learn the Flint lesson, because this was happening at the same time. But it's just sort of that kind of attitude and mentality is disturbing. I mean, we saw it in Flint where the state basically said there wasn't any problem with the water for, you know, 18 months, and then finally had to fess up and say, yeah, we were wrong. There was a problem. And you have this same kind of phenomenon playing out here with this unemployment claim issue. And it's just, I guess, as a citizen, you look at it, and that's not the kind of state government you want.
Ken Sekema is a Republican and senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants, as well as a former legislative leader. Vicki Barnett is a Democrat, the former mayor of Farmington Hills, and a former legislator. Thank you both for talking with me, and have a great weekend.
You too, Lester.
Hey, thank you.
179 years ago today, the Michigan Central Railroad began passenger service. A locomotive named Governor Mason, in honor of the new state's leader, embarked on its maiden voyage from Detroit to Ypsilanti. An excited crowd greeted the passengers. A fine meal was served. Toasts were made in celebration. The return trip, however, not so good. The engine broke down, and horses were brought in to pull the train back to Detroit. Easy there, Mr. Ed. After the break, we get some clarification on just what today's ruling from a federal judge in Detroit means for travelers, customs agents, and Border Patrol officers.
This makes absolutely clear that if you do not allow them entry, you'll be violating the federal court order. So it has grave implications, and it makes clear that you must allow them entry.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A federal judge in Detroit says U.S. green card holders shouldn't be affected by President Donald Trump's order temporarily banning refugees and immigrants from seven mostly Muslim countries. On the line with me now is Nabi Ayad. He's counsel with the Arab American Civil Rights League. So take us step by step. What does this order do?
You know, this order makes it permanent, and it's not a should. They must. All federal agents, the Department of Homeland Security, along with the Customs and Border Protection, must allow green card holders returning to the United States entry. So it makes clear, and it takes out the ambiguity and the anxiety that is out there as to individuals that are green card holders across the country, that whether they can fly and come back to the United States or whether they're overseas and they want to return to the United States. There has been ambiguity. As you know, there's over 100 of the green card holders that were detained last week, as well as those who were denied entry. And this makes absolutely clear that if you do not allow them entry, you'll be violating the federal court order. So it has grave implications, and it makes clear that you must allow them entry.
Hadn't the Trump White House already indicated that it didn't apply to green card holders?
Well, that's the thing. The indication, they started backing off on their initial executive order ban, which included possibly green card. They backed off after the number of litigations out there with the detention individuals that were detained. But this makes it clear because tomorrow they can literally change their mind, or tomorrow they can add, there's rumors of other countries to be added, and some of them possibly Hispanic countries. So this makes clear that you cannot disallow green card holders from entering the United States. So it makes firm, it takes the anxiety out of that individuals that are traveling, and it makes clear that they must allow them entry. And we're telling people to take this order with you, put it in your pocket while you're traveling or on your cell phone, so in case the customs would not allow you entry from different nations of the world. And we know for a fact that even after that, the made clarification from the White House, there were still people that were denied entry. We still have people denied entry as we speak today. So it just gives more teeth to the position that they have to allow these individuals entry.
Now, this in no way has any effect on the other orders regarding people holding visas or who are refugees.
Correct. And this is, we filed a two-part complaint, one for the legal permanent residents and one for the immigrant individuals that receive visas. Now, the difference, just listeners, the immigrant visas is literally a green card. Once you land in the United States and you're admitted, then you get the green card. So some of these individuals have been waiting 12, 13 years to get this immigrant visa, which is in essence going to be a green card when they land in the U.S. Those individuals have not been allowed entry. So this is a two-part complaint, and that will be argued next week, actually the following Monday in a federal court hearing at 9 a.m.
Yeah, as I understand it, the White House is to present its briefs earlier in the week, and you, the plaintiffs, filing your briefs later in the week. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
All right. That is Nabi Ayad. He is counsel with Arab American Civil Rights League. Thanks very much for explaining this to us.
Thank you, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Here's a question. What can we learn from children around us? Do we really even listen to them? Christopher Phillips has been listening and sharing what he's heard and learned from our youngest citizens. Phillips is the founder of Socrates Cafe. He's the author of The Philosopher's Club and most recently author of The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. That word in the title of your book, Childing. Tell me what that means.
Well, it turns out that childing is a mid-13th century term, and it translates into blossoming from a healthy core. Shakespeare used it to great effect in some of his plays, but it's all about how can we as individuals, as human beings, make sure that we flourish from a healthy core. I think we start out with a bang, with a really holistic way of looking at the world. We're hardwired for empathy. We're hardwired to use our reasoning skills. We might have a lot less evidence to use at a younger age, but we're hardwired for it in most cases. But something happens along the way, I think, and that our identity can become more blurry over time because we get caught up in the hurly-burly of everyday life and we forget about just this wonderful inherent sense of curiosity and our exploratory nature. So my philosophy of childing is sort of a philosophical look that's also blended with the latest cognitive science and neuroscience studies that show that we do indeed begin life with a bang and we often end up with a whimper because we don't keep trying to flourish or we don't have the tools and means and methods and ways to flourish as we go through every age and stage of life.
So how do we find that again if we've lost it?
Well, my view, based on 20 years of traveling around the globe philosophizing with children, is that we need kids in our orbit. And it's whether we're parents or childless, there are ways to engage with children, especially in philosophical inquiry. Sounds self-serving, I know, but you know, we have about 500 of these Socrates Cafe groups now around the globe, and they almost all of them are in public places and spaces. In fact, the overwhelming preponderance of them are in public libraries, which are these great bastions of democratic inclusiveness, not just of various socioeconomic strata, but of ages. So many of them are held in the children's section of libraries, and adults have to go into kids' space. And we philosophize with kids, and we start using 25-cent words instead of $50 words as we engage with them. And we realize that not only do they say the darndest things, but they can think in the darndest ways. They can frame questions in ways that we adults have forgotten how to do. I'll give you an example. Cosmologists, physicists are just getting with the program about multiverses. Kids have known this forever. I was an elementary school teacher. My God, they write papers about this all the time about how you know, there's universes within universes. Kids have known that time is no constant fixed things. Again, this is something that physicists are still just learning about. If we populated our research offices with kids, I truly make this argument, and if we didn't just tell them about what we're doing because we're sort of interested in helping them learn about new careers and that kind of stuff, but if we actually let them learn and absorb what we're doing, they could help us frame questions in newer and more thrilling and possibly portal-opening ways that would help us in our own inquiries that would enrich and enhance our pursuits.
I want to take you back to 1997 when you first started really talking with and hearing from kids. You used the open question, the Socratic method of talking with these kids. But that doesn't start out all that – well, it's a little chaotic. I mean, kids want to talk over each other. They want to, you know, interrupt. They all raise their hands at the same time, start talking at the same time. How do you develop to a point where you can actually hear these kids?
Okay, so let's use the Socratic method a little bit. Why is it that kids are that way? It's because quite often they're not used to having adults really listen to them. So they feel like they have to talk over one another because they're not used to really being attended to with their thoughts. And so once they get with the program and understand that they're genuinely going to be listened to, not just once but on many occasions, then suddenly they calm down and they begin to let their natural dispositions kick in and they begin listening to one another. They begin to listen what I call empathically with one another, with all their being. The mood changes quickly. This is what happened when I started the Philosopher's Club in the Mission District of San Francisco. These kids simply hadn't been listened to by adults. They've never had a chance in a formal setting to actually inquire with one another and to be looked at as equals with the teacher, that they could actually show the teacher maybe some new insights. So it changed. And I have to say, when I first started this out, it was a little more schoolmarmish. I was a little bit above the fray. So humility had to kick in a little bit. And I realized these kids, my mouth was constantly involuntarily dropping open with their insights. And I realized I wasn't teaching them anything. They were teaching me. Or at the very least, at the very we were really engaging just as fellow perplexed human beings, one of whom happened to be a lot older than them. And once I took off that teacher's hat, which can sort of be like a cloak, and began in that setting inquiring with them as just fellow human beings with worries, hopes, fears, aspirations, it changed the dynamic. It changed other teachers' ways of looking at kids. Teachers would come up to me and say, "What did you do to this child? This was my most problematic child, and now she's an angel." And I said, "Well, I inquired with her. I helped her develop that fourth R reasoning." And as a result, they become far more engaged, as they become more equipped to become fellow learners and inquirers with the teacher. But I think all too often we give short shrift to kids.
Tell me something in your life that's changed in a significant way because of something a child told you.
Well, my wife, Cecilia, and I, who I met at Socrates Cafe, she was the only one who showed up. We went to Chiapas, Mexico, where she had been a teacher, and we ended up living there for quite some time. And I held inquiries in the plaza with the central plaza with indigenous children. And
now tell me about the – I read about this.
Yes.
These children are not going to school.
No. Even though Mexico's constitution says every kid goes to school, millions don't. And these kids sell their beautiful hand-woven goods in the plaza for 12, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. But I do. I would bring, you know, hot tea and some things to eat, and we would cluster for a little while and have an inquiry. So they don't have a formal education, but they have this earthy wisdom born from their very unique experiences. And I would ask a question like, what is a good human being? And this one child named Varuch would say, well, I don't know what that is, but I can tell you what a true human being is. And I said, okay, well, what is that? She says, well, by our Mayan Tzeltal concept, a true human being is someone who, you know, you're born into the world as a human being, but to become a true human being, you have to demonstrate certain acts and deeds. And I said, well, what would that be? Thinking she was going to come up with something, you know, fancy but predictable. And she said, well, for me, a true human being is someone, when I try to sell them something, at least politely says no. I thought, wow, that's really – I said, well, why? She goes, because so many people, locals and adult and tourists who travel through, they just blow right past me. Many of them intentionally try to push me over and make me fall. But a true human being, she said, and she looked at me, said, like you. She said, you said no thank you because you'd already bought a mountain of things from other kids by the time I got to you. She goes, that to me is a true human being. You have to demonstrate it that way. And so that's really how this whole concept of the philosophy of childing was born, this notion that children are different, that they have different capacities, different stores of wisdom, and yet they're equal in the sense that they are fellow human beings already imbued with lots of rich experiences that we adult human beings could learn a lot from if we would quit thinking of our next zinger and just listen to them with all our being.
I don't want to turn this into a superficial conversation, but as I was reading some of your material, I kept thinking about that column that was once written, Everything I Needed to Know About Life I Learned as a Kindergartner. Is there some kind of a simile or parallel there?
Well, in the sense, if we look at kids' ability to frame metaphysical questions, and if we look at how our ability as adults is much more limited in that regard, I mean, kids can, in some cases, can make gorgeous paintings. Kids are hardwired to learn lots of different languages. That's a short window, and then it closes. There clearly is a malleability of mind, which I would also say is added to a malleability of heart, that quite often peaks in kindergarten age if we don't tap into it and cultivate it in ways that keep that malleability of mind and heart throughout our lives. And so what I'm trying to argue in the philosophy of childing and back up with lots and lots of pioneering cognitive science evidence is that we don't have to end up life with a whimper if we keep cultivating and nurturing those skills. Our reasoning skills change over time. Our empathy skills change over time. But they can change in ways that are sort of an outward and upward expanding spiral if we never lose that childlike sensibility of inquiring into anything and everything under the sun.
Kids grow up. You tell an interesting story about – you have two daughters, Callie and Sibley. You tell a story about walking Callie to school each day, and as time goes on, things change a little bit, and you question, where will it go? Where will this relationship with my own child mm-hmm. go, and how long will I be able to mm-hmm. learn those things from her? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I wonder when's the last time that she's going to instinctively grab my hand as we walk to school? When is the last time that she's going to call me Daddy instead of Dad? Lots of different things. The connecting thread for me with my child is Callie, and she's been traveling with me since she was 11 days old around the globe in my inquiries, is our Socrates cafes. And so now I record them. Well, there's a bunch of them now posted on YouTube that show me Socratizing with Callie starting at a very, very young age. I hope I became a dad the first time at 47, so I hope that I hope I live a long time. But I hope that Callie looks back at all these videos of our Socratizing together. And any question like the latest question that we did was on something like, what are the best kinds of loyalty? Because she was taken to task because she sort of told on a couple kids at school who were doing something really rotten. And the teacher actually said, well, she shouldn't have done that. And I'm thinking, wait a second. These kids were getting the gardener in trouble because they were planning things that made it look like he'd stolen stuff. So I thought she did a noble and honorable thing. So we talked about when should we defend someone? When should we – and when should we maybe let others know that they've done something that may be considered morally wrong? Because quite often adults are not really – they can be very, very fixed about their notions of that and be very hypocritical about that. But at the very least, I think if we begin with a foundational inquiry into morality, it's amazing the impact that can have on a child rather than trying to beat them over the head with your own sensibility of right and wrong.
Now, there are Socrates cafes all over Michigan. Are we hearing these kind of conversations during these gatherings?
We are. Michigan is rich with Socrates cafes from our dialogue initiatives, from Birmingham, Michigan, to Baldwin Public Library, to Troy Historic Village. They're all over the state. And what's thrilling about this is I started this 20 years ago, the Socrates Cafe, and they have a staying power. The groups here have been in existence for quite a number of years, and groups still form. And they really form in places and spaces where people of many, many walks of life and sensibilities feel quite comfortable coming in at a time when arguably there's even more polarization today than when I started these 20 years ago when there was a lot of polarization. So I find that heartening in some way. I think that civil deliberation is a nice thing if we behave, but I don't think that's nearly enough. I think we got to inquire together and discover common ground if we're ever really going to be open to creative solutions to our most vexing problems.
Christopher Phillips is the author of The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I don't know if you heard me say this earlier, but Michigan is one of only a couple of states that don't subject the governor and the legislature to open record laws. The Michigan legislature, though, Republicans and Democrats, are signing on to legislation which would expand the state's open records law. Part of that bill is part of that package is an 11-bill package known as Legislative Open Records Act. The chief sponsor is Republican Representative Lee Chatfield, and he joins us right now. The proposal is similar to legislation introduced last session. The Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff basically spiked that last year. What did you change to increase the chances of getting it through the Senate this time?
Well, Lester, thanks for the opportunity to be on and to talk about this important package of bills. And as we approach it this term, we started with the same place that we finished last year. However, obviously, we changed a couple of the dates for its implementation because it failed to pass last year. But we're starting fresh, and the House is starting with what we feel is a great start to have this conversation. So I do look forward, as does Speaker Leonard, to having an open and healthy conversation with the Senate Majority Leader and the governor to see what compromises we can make and if we can come together to subject the governor and the legislature to the Freedom of Information Act.
Well, opposition, or the reason that Arlen Meekhoff said he didn't like it last time, is because it would allow the Freedom of Information Act to be used to look at correspondence with constituents, and he objected to that. Did you change that?
I do believe the package that is now being presented in the Michigan Competitiveness Committee does address concerns that people have regarding the privacy of constituent correspondence. And that is an issue. People are reaching out to our offices with some of the most sensitive material in their lives. And I do think that correspondence needs to be protected. However, it's our job in the House to convince them that this package of bills does address their concerns. However, the Speaker's been very open. He looks forward to having these conversations with him as it moves through the process to ensure that we can all come to an agreement on that. Because I don't think we should let something like that get in the way of having transparency and accountability in our government. The people of Michigan demand it, and the House of Representatives is determined to deliver on that.
Well, you can see how it might be seen as a huge loophole. I mean, if a legislator's constituent was a huge donor and correspondence between the two included discussions of favors, a sort of pay for play, that might be something that people might want to know. It seems like that should be transparent too, right?
It should be transparent. Our responses, Lester, will be open to the public. And obviously there is going to be some area in these package of bills where there's always going to be some things that can be done offline. And I understand that, and I'm going to acknowledge that. However, I do think this is a meaningful first step that the legislature takes to ensure that we have additional transparency and accountability. And at the end of the day, you're going to send someone to Lansing that you trust their judgment, you trust their character, and I do believe when the time comes when you no longer trust their judgment or character, you send someone else to Lansing. However, I do think this is a good first step. I think it's needed. I think the public wants it, and I hope we can deliver it.
Well, let's narrow down on this a little bit because, you know, one of the interesting things is how you define constituent. Is constituent limited to the resident of your district? Could it be somebody who doesn't live there but owns a business in your district? Could it be someone who doesn't include an address in an email? Do you presume that person is a constituent and exempt from the Freedom of Information Act?
Well, because we can't just subject the legislature to the Freedom of Information Act, we had to create an entire new act, the Legislative Open Records Act. And the intent of this law is for someone living within your district. This does not apply to someone who is a registered lobbyist, because we want to ensure that there is no official business, like you mentioned, favors being done. And this is about opening
it up. Well, you don't have to be a lobbyist to ask for favors.
No, I understand that. But this is intended to ensure more transparency and accountability. And I do think it's a meaningful first step. And I do not want to let perfect get in the way of good policy. And I think this is moving us in the right direction. It'll ensure that Michigan is a more transparent and accountable government.
So what do we really gain here? I mean, what do you mean when you say more transparent legislature or transparent government? What will the people gain with this if some of this is off the record?
Well, they'll be able to have access to the emails I send to state departments, emails I send to other legislators, emails I even send to some constituents. They will be able to have access to my schedule. I think the people should know who their representative is meeting with throughout the day. And, I mean, when we look at the President of the United States, we have access to his schedule. But if someone calls my office and wants to know how my time is being spent, they don't have access to that. So I think we're starting with what we think is good policy. We'll continue to move it through the committee process, and hopefully when it gets over to the Senate, be able to negotiate with them. But this is just allowing them, the constituents, the people of Michigan, to know how their legislators are spending their time, who they're corresponding with, and how they're working. As long as we're receiving taxpayer dollars, I think those taxpayers should have access.
So if the Legislative Open Records Act is passed more or less like it is right now, and you say that this is a good first step, will you be pursuing in future sessions of the legislature something that might actually open all of your public business to public records laws?
Well, I do think that all our business will be open to public records law under this. Again, what we're trying to protect is the sensitivity of constituent correspondence that might be private. And like I said, I mean, there's a lot of people who will email us very sensitive material. It could be a family issue that they're having, could be something that they're dealing with that they just need help with. We do want to ensure that that's protected. And to answer the question, I always think it's important that we look for ways in state government to find where we can be more transparent and accountable to the people. And what we did in this Legislative Open Records Act, we examined, you know, the other states that have this and tried to codify what the majority of them have. So I think this is good policy. I think it's needed, and I hope we can see it through.
Representative Lee Chatfield is a Republican from the 107th Michigan House District. He's chief sponsor of a package of bills that would expand open records laws to the legislature. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Lester, appreciate the opportunity.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There's a lot of talk and a lot of press about Detroit as the comeback city. And it's true, there's a lot of development taking place in the city's business districts. But in the neighborhoods, it's a different story. Unemployment is high, money is short. Recently, a Detroit reporter wrote an article for Bloomberg about Detroit's underground economy, or as she calls it, a gift economy or sharing economy. Valerie Vandepan joins us now. And we also have Jessica Ramirez with Detroiters Helping Each Other, a store that's something like a thrift store, except it gives away items such as donated clothes and other goods. Valerie, let's start with the basics. How does this alternative economy work?
So it's a little bit different from a barter system. So a lot of people read the story and they were like, wow, Detroit's doing barter. Economists tend to think of barter as I'll give you one loaf of bread for 1 pound of meat or something like that. And it's a system that tends to take place when people don't know one another and they want to make sure their exchange is equal. What's happening in Detroit is a gift economy. And what that means is that whatever people have that they can share, they do. And what people need, they take. And everyone in that way is able to have their basic needs met. So it's the kind of system that can exist when you have a community that has been around for a long time and that people think will be there in years to come. So there's no, you know, if someone in your neighborhood needs something, you can give it to them because at some point in the future, they might have something that you need and you know that they'll still be there.
So this is sort of a formalized neighbor helping neighbor.
I wouldn't even call it formalized. It's hard to measure these kinds of things because, you know, it's taking place oftentimes in people's homes or these aren't transactions that are being recorded. These are support systems and networks that are formed out of absolute necessity. We're talking about people, you know, they don't have jobs. They don't have cash readily available. You know, you can't go out and just buy a refrigerator when yours dies. So, you know, you've got hungry mouths to feed. How do you, you know, keep food fresh? And that's where places like what Jessica does become so important because if, say, you know, you're lucky enough to be able to purchase a new refrigerator and you get one and you have your old one, it still works fine. You can give it to Detroiters Helping Each Other. And then when somebody needs a refrigerator, they can just give it to you. And it's a safety net in the poor parts of the city.
Jessica, tell us how your story, Detroiters Helping Each Other, work.
Well, when we started it in 2013, I actually worked with animals. I worked in rescue. And with helping the animals, I kept seeing that if families needed help with the animals, they needed help inside their home. So we started bringing the families that we were helping with animals. I was networking for clothes and stuff. We did it out of my home for a little over a year. I had 3 rooms set up. And all we do is if somebody has an item needed, we'll post it on our personal page and we ask. And if somebody has it, they can drop it off. We'll take it or we'll pick it up. And then we go through our list for like big ticket items like refrigerators and stoves. Those are so hard to come by. And there's a mile long list for those. You know, our number one priority are CPS cases and fire victims. CPS cases, because we want to help keep the families together. And then, you know, fire victims, they pretty much lose everything. So we try to make that transition of their time in need as easy as possible. So then we just do everyday stuff where we have clothing, household items, kitchenware. People can just come in and get what they need. You know, some families, single moms, like what I was saying, refrigerators die. You know, they lose all the food. We just went through that with a mother with five children.
I want to ask you a little bit about these CPS cases a little further. Child Protective Services, that basically the state is saying, we're going to take your kids if you don't get this in the house. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Yes. So we help the best we can. Right now we're working on trying to get twin-size beds for two families right now. And we've been putting the plea out for like almost a week or two now, and we still haven't get them. But we don't give up.
Who donates to it? Is it just a certain neighborhood, a certain part of town, or do you
No, we help and we network and collaborate with all over Michigan. We have people from Kentucky, California, Pennsylvania, Texas send us stuff. It's a statewide. It's everywhere. It comes from all over the place. And a lot of our donations come from downriver. We have a big support system. One of our biggest support system is Mayor Patty Odette from Woodhaven. She is phenomenal with us. If I really need help and we're not getting luck, I'll contact her and she'll put a plea out. And she helps our community tremendously.
Valerie, you write that some of these gift economy scenarios include things like people driving other people to the hospital when they need to go instead of calling an ambulance. Why wouldn't they just call the ambulance?
Well, I think if you've been a resident of Detroit for a long period of time, you've lost a bit of confidence in the response times to EMT and
the mayor's office has been telling us for more than a year that they've really cut the time down. Is you're not finding that to be the case in the neighborhoods?
Well, they, you know, they do tout those numbers, and they those numbers do look good. But at the same time, you're talking about neighborhoods that have been marginalized and disenfranchised for a generation or more. And so, what's happened is people have created these community support networks with vehicle sharing. You know, not everybody can afford to have a car. Not everybody can afford the insurance on the vehicles. As we all know, it's very high here in Michigan. So what happens is people create plans. So if there is an emergency, there's somebody they can call upon to get to the hospital, to get to kidney dialysis, to get to work. There's also situations, I interviewed a woman, she didn't end up in the story, but she was so excited. She was 21. She just got her first car. And she was so excited to be able to give all of the people in her immediate area rides because nobody had a car. She was the first person in her area to have a car. And we're talking about a place where, you know, the taxi services are just, you might wait 3 or 4 hours to never for a car service to show up, a taxi. A lot of people don't have smartphones. So, you know, there's no Uber or Lyft for them. And they still need to get around. Public transit is poor. So these kinds of car sharing where you either share your car, you share your keys with your neighbor, or you have neighbors who you can rely on to get you where you need to be, or especially in an emergency situation, that becomes a vital safety net and a vital sense of security for people who wouldn't otherwise be able to get around.
Jessica, people in the neighborhoods wonder if they'll ever benefit or be allowed to share in the prosperity that's taking place in certain business districts in Detroit. How do you think that might happen?
I think if the community keeps sticking together and working together, that we can bring the grassroots back. I mean, it's all about as we say it at Detroiters, is teamwork makes the dream work. If we work together and if we have 10 goals and we come together as a team and work on one or two of them small ones, we're accomplishing something to work up to that big goal, and we're going to make things better. People can doubt Detroit all they want, but at the end of the day, we stick up for each other, and we're there for each other.
Valerie, I have one more question. I've heard more than one neighborhood leader say they got by a long time without any kind of city services before bankruptcy and after bankruptcy. The last thing they want now is the city coming in and demanding permits or requiring inspections for maybe little shops or restaurants that have developed to serve neighborhoods when the city was not serving them. How widespread is that sentiment?
I think it's everywhere. I think people have really, like Jessica said, stuck together. And, you know, these community support networks are the reason there's a Detroit that's here for people to move to now. And I think that that's important to remember. These families and these generations of Detroiters have stuck together and have made it work through thick and thin in the city. And they don't want to see what happened to, for example, Black Bottom, Paradise Valley.
Places that were wiped off the map.
Completely. And they don't want to see that happen. And then, of course, you know, you wipe a place off the map and then you decide to recreate it. Like, they think the city's trying to recreate Paradise Valley now. That's one of their plans, is to recreate the entertainment of Paradise Valley and some of the few remaining buildings. But they're evicting the people who live in those buildings now in order to do that. You know, at some point, I think...
That's a little more than irony there, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important, you know, to recognize what people are doing and how they're doing it. And they're doing it in what's really a healthy community way, the best way that they can. And how do you, you know, how can you incorporate that with the further development in the city? And it's not like I have a magic solution or the perfect answer to that question, but I think it's an important question to engage the communities and the neighborhoods on. You know, what are you doing here, and how can we support you in continuing the in keeping these networks together so we don't tear that very fabric apart and destroy something that is quite special.
Valerie Van de Pen wrote the article "Life Without Money in Detroit's Survival Economy" for Bloomberg. Jessica Ramirez operates the store Detroiters Helping Each Other. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having us on.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
That's our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.